There we go. All right, they've closed the doors, which means we're locked in here. You guys are awfully spread out. I'm wondering if I should make you all scoot in, but instead I'll just have to pace back and forth and talk to you guys over here and then go back over there. Well, thank you guys for coming out. 5 o'clock, halfway through the conference. Everybody having a good time so far? Yes? Good, seeing some good stuff, learning. Hopefully you're enjoying a lot all the great talks on the new 2012 versions of Visual Studio and TFS, in addition to, of course, all the great stuff you're learning about Windows 8. So I've been, I know a few of you have already been to some of the talks I've been giving on the unit testing side of things, but for this release, I have also been very involved with the teams that have been exploring the entire of the Agile scenario for Visual Studio 2012 and for TFS. I was supposed to be joined up here by one of my colleagues from the TFS team, but due to a scheduling snafu, he's not here to be with me, so I'm going to cover the whole thing. Hopefully we'll do a good job and give you coverage. Now, it's not a gigantic room. It's a reasonably good-sized room, but there's only a few of you here, so please don't be afraid to put your hand up if you have a question. I will call on you. If you can get to a mic, that would be great, because the recording people would love it. If you can't, I will repeat your question back so that we get it all recorded well. All right, I'm Peter Provost. I'm a program manager lead on the Visual Studio Ultimate team. My focus, as I said, has been mostly unit testing, but my team has actually been using and consuming the stuff I'm going to show you today almost since before it worked. We were early adopters of all of this Agile stuff because my team works that way. We actually use Scrum in our crew. We sit in a team room, we pair program, we TDD, we do all that other stuff together. Now, a question for all of you, I need to kind of get a sense of the temperature. How many of you back at your offices would say that what you do right now at work is an Agile project management technique? You guys use Agile. We'll say that. Okay. And how many are using TFS right now with your... Okay. Good. So you guys just want to see what the new stuff is then, because we're all using it, and you want to see what we've done to make it better. Excellent. So let's see. I've got a clicker here, which hopefully will help us get started. Okay, I'm going to be taking us through kind of a day in the life, or not a single day, of course. We're going to be looking at the entirety of an Agile team working with this new 2012 TFS and Visual Studio product suite. We're going to take this in four big chunks. We're going to start by thinking about the prioritization work. This is something that we sometimes call grooming the backlog, or managing the backlog, or prioritizing the backlog. This is where you're thinking about your business. You're thinking about the whole suite of your work work that's coming. You prioritize it, you analyze it, you break it down, you adjust it. And that's something that you're going to be doing constantly if you're the product owner. Now, I was the product owner for my team, so this was really a pretty major part of my job. Second part is we're going to get into the planning. This is where you're actually doing a discrete chunk of work. We call them in Scrum a sprint, but almost all of the iterative and agile methodologies have got some variation of that, where we stop for and we work for a certain amount of time, and then we reflect on what we did and we do it again. We plan in these small, constant, recurring increments. We'll get into the execution, and I'm going to be very brief there and talk about the tooling in Visual Studio, about how an Agile developer works. I think that's actually been covered pretty well by some of my other talks. I will cover it, but I'm going to focus mostly on the broad Agile play here. And then at the end, about how responding to change causes us to revisit each one of those steps and bring it all back around, and we continue that thing all the way through. So you guys all put your hands up, so that means you've all read the Agile Manifesto. Right? Everybody knows the Agile Manifesto, or maybe we don't. Yeah, we've got at least one hand up over there. So a lot of people misunderstand the Agile Manifesto, and that's why I decided to put this slide in here and have a quick talk about it. The Agile Manifesto does not say don't do documentation. It says we prefer working software over the production of documentation. We're not in the business of making documentation. We will. We do. It is often required and important, but it is not what we're here to do. We're here to build software. And that's what matters. Same kind of thing in processes and tools. It's always kind of funny for me to point out the one that I have purple in this slide because, of course, here I am. I'm a tools guy. I work for a company that's producing tools. You guys all raised your hands and said, we're using your tools, and yet I'm going to say to you, as an agilist, we care more about the people, the teams, how they work, the individuals and the interactions, than we care about the tools. The blue one, customer collaboration over contract negotiation. Historically, you have to understand that the Agile Manifesto was created by people who were predominantly consultants. And what they had observed is that they get into this situation where they go into a customer site to start to establish the contract that is the deal. How many of you are in consulting or contracting? Okay, I did it for 15 years. I know it pretty well. And of course, the customer wants what? Does he want a fixed price, fixed bid, fixed scope contract? And the point that these guys were trying to make is that, in fact, we would rather not do that because that's just a fail situation. You can't lock in the three sides of the triangle, the project management triangle. And we'd rather work with the customer, have conversations with them, talk about what's happening, and be able to embrace the change that they want to do as the software evolves. And of course, that responding to change instead of following a plan. We plan constantly. But we don't try to follow a plan, a great big giant book of a plan that we created ages ago. Then if you are familiar with the Agile Manifesto and you've spent some time here, I would encourage you all to go back to that site again and click the link at the bottom, because I'm amazed how many people have read these four things and not clicked through to the things behind, which are the principles that underlie this. Those are actually better in my book, but it fills up a slide with words. So, but it's the things that lead us to these kinds of, I prefer this over that. So let's go ahead and drive right in and start looking at that first phase of our project, this phase of prioritizing our work. So I mentioned that I am a product owner inside of Visual Studio, inside of the Visual Studio Ultimate product. What does that mean? Well, it means that my job is to come here and talk to you, go to user groups, troll the forums, Twitter, email, talk to the people who buy our products, listen to them, understand, learn, and from that, derive the work that we want to build in the next release or in the next patch or in the next update. And I put that into a thing we call the product backlog. The act of organizing and prioritizing our product backlog is really the single most important job that the product owner does. And it is an act of prioritization. And people often strongly resist this idea of producing a linear stack rank. This is more important than that. I know from speaking to my own management inside of Visual Studio and even talking to my wife, because she'll have the list, the honey-do list. Everybody got a honey-do list, right? I got the honey-do list at home, and I say, okay, well, which one do you really want me to do? She said, I want them all. No, honey, I only have so much time this weekend. Which one do you want? I want them all, okay? If you can't have one, which one would you choose not to have? And I find that coming at it backwards like that works really, really well. Turns out it also works really well when you're thinking about prioritizing your product backlog. You got 13 items on the backlog. Pretend you can only have 12. Okay, now, pretend you can only have 11. And you play it backwards, up from the bottom, and you'll discover that you will find the single most important item on your backlog. And you might often be surprised at which one it is when you come at it with that backwards kind of a way. It works really well. But this is the job of the product owner, to define what the product is and to prioritize that work so that we make sure we're always building the most important thing next. So we do that, we slide that item up, and we've now readjusted. Notice that these are sized. This is another important aspect of all of the Agile project management disciplines, but in Scrum as well. We want to be able to make sure that we have a sense of the relative size of these things. When we are prioritizing work, it turns out that how big it is actually a pretty important variable to the priority. So I can say this. All right, that is a 10 on the business value scale. Wonderful. And then the development team comes back and says it's going to cost $1 million. Okay, well, it's not worth that. Right? I mean, clearly I want it, but I'm not going to pay $1 million for it. See, push it down the list. It's not important enough anymore. So there is an issue or a component of that prioritization that comes from the size of the item. And so it is important that you have a measure of size. Now, when you look at a lot of the literature in Scrum and in other frameworks for agile development, sometimes they'll recommend that you use a thing called story points. If you go back 5-8 years ago when we were doing agile, they were even doing such crazy things as calling them jelly beans. I think their point was to get out of the business of trying to get things in units that people would recognize, right? Because if I put it in days, well, then the boss is going to say, you said 4 days. Took you 8. What's the problem? But if you say it's 4 jelly beans, boss has no way to get you. And again, it gets back to that contract negotiation problem. Personally, I will tell you, based on my own experience of having done this now for 10 years, I use real time. I do. It works. And with enough conversations with my management, with my key stakeholders, I can make them understand that these are forecasts, these are estimates, these are best I can do right now kind of numbers. These are not commitments. They're not real. But I'm using them to impact my prioritization. I think it's about that big. Therefore, I think I can put it here in the backlog. So there are some other important aspects to an item on the product backlog. And so you want to make sure that it isn't just, you know, a single word, a single sentence. There's some really key components above and beyond saying what it is. And really, the most important one is probably that idea of the acceptance criteria. You'll find this crops up all across Agile project management and Agile disciplines in general, is having a clear understanding of the definition of done. This is about done for a product backlog item, for a user story. What is it going to take for you, the product owner, to say, I'll accept it, I'll take it, it's good enough, I'll ship it? And you want to make sure you spend the time to establish the acceptance criteria. On our teams, I work very closely with our QA organization while doing that, because I've found that they are really good at helping me think of funny little edge cases in the acceptance criteria. Because, you know, I've said this in a few of my talks this week, I am a really crappy tester. I'm one of those guys who happy paths through everything. And once I figure out it works, I have a very difficult time deviating. And so sometimes I'm not very good at finding those really weird edge cases through a user story or through a feature, whereas these guys can be really good at it. So I like to collaborate with them very closely to come up with the acceptance criteria. So in addition to I can this, I can that, if I do that, this happens. Weird edge case stuff. Very good, very important thing is to try to think about who else can help you produce those acceptance criteria and get them right. So I'm going to jump over to my number two machine here, and we're going to start taking a look at the product, because this is probably what you guys really wanted to see. It's funny, I had it on two, but not on the other. Okay. So what you're seeing here, I am using the TFS preview. Have you guys seen this? Anybody already have an account at the TFS preview? Okay, good. So I'm using TFS preview, and I'm using the Scrum 2.0 template. And so I'm actually running live up there. Hopefully the network stays good for me. And what I want to take you through is the tools that are available to us in the TFS preview and therefore in the TFS on-premises product. Now understand, I want to be crystal clear, both for the recording and for those of you who are thinking about this. The TFS preview is always going to have newer stuff in it than the product you install off the CD, because it actually reinstalls and updates very, very frequently. Nice thing about being a service hosted in the cloud, right? And then what's going to happen is every now and then those are going to be refreshed back to you in the product. So if you're using TFS on-premises, then it might be slightly different at any given time. I think right now if you were to grab the RC, you'll find that they're pretty much in sync together. So we're talking about the product backlog. So what I want to do here at this point is click into the product backlog. All right, so the product backlog. Have any of you guys tried to do Scrum and project management type things in TFS 2010? I'm sure, because I did. This is the reason I said I was such an early adopter of this when it came online. The way I used to do this in order to stack rank things, in order to get them into a nice list, is, of course, I would take my work item query and I'd open it up in Excel. And I'd get it to show me that stack rank column, and I would do that old, old basic trick of go by increments of 10. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. So then when I need to move somebody up, I'll put him at 55. Oh, I still got 5 left. And put this guy at 52. And you know, you start squeeze them in like that by manually adjusting that number. Not at all a fun way to deal with it. Well, nice thing about our new web-based API is when I want to prioritize, I grab it, I drag it, I drop it. And I want you to see how fast this is as I am reprioritizing this backlog. And remember, I'm using a web connection right here, same network you've been on here this whole time, against the live TFS preview. A lot of work has been done on both the web API and on the services that sit behind it to get us this interactive, this rich experience where you are no longer waiting for these queries to go all the way back and forth. It's all very dynamic, very interactive, which as a product owner is great because it means I can just sit and drag these things back and forth. Now, the other thing that happens is the same kind of a thing. You said, yes, I used to do exactly the same thing with the steps of 10 in our Excel, and I think I saw you over there too. The other one is, of course, when you want to add a new one. Right, you want to put a new one in. Well, this is kind of nice, so I'm going to make sure the bottom one's active. I'm going to go over here on the right-hand side and turn on the Add Items box. So now when I want to add new items, it's literally just keep typing. Right? I can just keep doing this all day. And what I'm doing is I'm sticking all these items in my product backlog, and they're all appearing down here at the bottom. As fast as you want, you can put them in. Now, of course, we probably don't really do this, but where you're just sitting and typing in 100 items. But there will be times, maybe like I'll come back from a conference, having spent the last week with you guys talking about the feature, talking about the products, and I got four or five things I know I need to put in. Right? Messing around with Excel and messing around with open the work item and hit save and close, and open the thing and hit save and close, and open the thing and hit save. This is not fun. I want to do this. I want to put them in. I want to drag and drop them. I want to put them where I want. So this is a very nice way for us as a product owner to work with it. Of course, there are still things we have to do. I mentioned things like business value. I mentioned things like effort, story points, and those kinds of things. So of course, I can just open them up. You notice how fast that opened again? Very, very quick. Open it up, and I can start to put in things like, I'll give this a business value of 5. Maybe I'm using a 5-point scale. It's 2 story points. It's on this little feature area. It's new. I can put in my acceptance criteria right here. I can set it up as a nice formatted bulleted list. Acceptance criteria 1. Right, I put them in, define them out, work with my QA team, all that, get it all defined in here. A nice, easy description. As a user, I want to, user of the product, I want to have fun at TechEd. Right? Nice and easy, fast, everything just works the way it should. Question here, yes, sir?
Can you add more fields to that screen?
Can I add more fields to this screen? So yeah, I come up here, I click column options, pick all the fields I want, show them. So the question is, can I modify the work item type? So of course, for your on-premises TFS instance, you can modify the work item type, because in order to modify a TFS work item type, you have to create a new process template, which involves editing a file called a WIT. And there is actually tools in the Team Foundation Power Tools that allow you to do this and to design the form and everything. When you're using TFS in the cloud, you do not have that control. You basically are stuck with the process template that you chose when you created your project. For this particular project, I used the Scrum 2.0 template, and so that's what I have. I can't add new work item types when I'm using the TFS service in the cloud. Yes, sir? Oh, yeah, we'll be at sprints in just a minute. We'll keep going. Yes, sir? Can I put pictures in there? So, yeah, we can put all kinds of things in there. We have got attachments that we can attach. We can attach pretty much anything we want. In the description part over here, you can attach an image right here, yes. Okay. All right, let me just keep going. We'll come up to some more planning stuff in a minute, but I want to point out that on the left-hand side, of course, we've got our sprints are showing up, and it's only showing me future sprints. I chose that. I can also have it show me old sprints. And if you really do like working with the old TFS work item view, you can click up here. You can create all your own queries. You can run your own queries, and that stuff's all here as well. Nice thing is that it's leveraging all of the improvements that we made to the web-based API services underneath, so it's also running at the same kind of speed that we've had running everything else running. Okay. Let's jump back over here. Okay, so again, we're talking about the Scrum 2.0 template in TFS, and what I'm showing you is the TFS service running that same template. So creating work items now is a much easier task than it's been. Prioritizing them is exactly the way you expected it to be and the way you wanted it to be. We don't have to mess around with Excel or crazy fields anymore. But that's only part of the job of the team as we're building out software, because remember, our goal is software, not tools and not documentation. So we need to now get into planning. And planning is an activity that we do, if we're talking about a Scrum situation, that we do once every sprint. Scrum calls for 30-day sprints. Different teams use different sizes. My teams have been working with 3-week sprints for absolutely no good reason other than somebody decided they would be 3 weeks long. Personally, I've always been a fan of them to be a little bit shorter. I don't think there's a good reason for why you choose one way or the other. I like them smaller because I find smaller makes me make the work smaller, which means I actually have more accurate forecasting of what's coming. So as we start to think about planning, what do we need to accomplish in order to plan a sprint or an iteration? We need to be able to look back in time and think about how much have we proven that we can accomplish over any particular iteration. And we'll use that to inform us as to what we can select going forward. So we're going to look at our product backlog, which we have been maintaining in a nicely stack-ranked manner. We don't let things go fallow. We want to make sure we're always working on that product backlog and keeping the things at the top prioritized. And we're going to look back in time, find that, and we need to now start bringing the work across and let the team participate in the estimation of it. I show the cards here because, have you guys heard of planning poker? All right, planning poker is an activity or a technique that teams have used for quite a while to do estimation or to do sizing of the work. I actually prefer sizing. Because one of the things that you want to try to make sure you do is that your goal with sizing of a backlog item and the tasks that are associated with it is not actually to figure out how long it's going to take to get it done. It's to figure out whether you can finish it in the sprint. Your goal is to be able to forecast accurately, not to be able to hold people's feet to the fire. And planning poker is an excellent way to do that because it helps to find discrepancies of opinion in the team. So four of us are a team. We do hold up our cards. I hold up a 3, you hold up a 4, you hold up a 5, you hold up a 12. That's an interesting conversation. You know, we want to talk then about why do you think it's 12? All the rest of us think it's about 4. And that conversation is very, very valuable, and that's actually the most important part, is to get a sense of rough order of magnitude. That's going to let us forecast, and that's going to let us make reasonable projections about how much work we can finish. Having done that, then, we're going to accept work into the sprint. And we may adjust priorities on the way, or adjust sizes, which can even affect priorities. So we're going to take the work, then, after we've done some more improved sizing on it, and we're going to start pulling it across into the sprint backlog. The sprint backlog is the execution track of this iteration's work. We start pulling these stories across, starting to do some planning on them. Now, for the teams, the developers and the testers and the entirety of the team to actually estimate something at the size of a product backlog item or a user story, they're going to need to task it out. They break it down into more discrete units that they can estimate in real time that they can really understand. Add the stored procedures, create a new view model, change this, change that. So we do that by creating tasks, which are children then, in TFS. Okay? Now we've got a sense of it. But we have a problem. We thought that last one was going to fit. It doesn't. So because it doesn't fit, what do we do? We have a couple of choices here. We can split it. We can split that story to be 2 stories. And I will warn you, splitting stories is difficult. Because, of course, we have to make sure that any story, any product backlog item, is something that delivers customer value on its own. But it also has to be something that we can complete in the sprint. And if it has to deliver customer value on its own, you can't just split it by saying, oh, we'll do the first 4 tasks and then the second 4 tasks. Because halfway through, what do you have? Nothing. You can't deliver it. You can't even demonstrate it. So what we're going to do is we're going to put it back. We can't finish that one because we couldn't figure out how to split it smaller. So we're going to put it back and we're going to take the next one and task it out using the same techniques, let the team work on it. And like I said, there are a lot of different ways to do this. There's a lot of different opinions and approaches about this. I'm telling you how I do it, how we do it. You may find that you would rather leave it where it is and go ahead and do it and not finish it. I'm not a big fan of that. I really do think that you should strive for finishing the work you start. We'll talk more about that closer to the end. Now, there's a bit of a shift that has been happening in Scrum in particular around the word commit. I wish my friend David Starr was here to chime in on this. David is part of Scrum.org, and he's at ABOF just down the hall a little bit. And he and I have had a lot of conversations about this. The word commit has proven to be very problematic in the definition of Scrum, because it turns out it became a hold your feet to the fire kind of a thing. You would say, we committed to these product backlog items. We committed to these stories. And then when the sprint ends and you find you didn't actually finish the last one, because as we all know, stuff happens. You know, you feel like you have to suddenly start pulling all-nighters and work all weekend, and the boss is going to get pissed at you. And that's actually not something that either Scrum or any of the other agile project management disciplines are going to encourage us to do. They're going to encourage us to do sustainable pace, which doesn't mean slack off, but it does mean don't pull a weekender every single sprint. It means be open and honest and talk about it. So the word commit has proven to be challenging, and in the current Scrum guide, you'll find that actually it's been removed. And they don't talk about committing anymore. They talk about forecasting. So let's look then at how we will how we interact with the TFS, the new TFS stuff. I'll be using the TFS preview again. I'm exactly where we were. And how we manage this process. So suppose we are planning out our sprint 6. Okay? And actually, let's do sprint 7. Already got some stuff in 6. So what I'm going to need to be able to do is I need to be able to take the work and put it in the sprint. Well, that's probably like that. Exactly what you were going to expect. Drag it over, put it in. This is how we commit to the work. Now, how do we know if we're over? How do we know how we're doing from a planning perspective? Well, there's a lot of things that we can do to keep track of this. We haven't put any tasks in yet, so we really don't know how big things are yet. So this is where the team is going to now start sitting down and talking. We're going to get everybody together in a room, hand out the planning poker cards, and start doing some task breakout. So breaking out the tasks is not that hard either. So we'll add the Sprock, if I can spell it. We'll update the view model. These are some of the things I was making up earlier, right? Change the UI, all the things we might need to do. Put some down here as well. Now, what I've found, this is the way my teams like to work, is that we'll actually figure out the tasks without even having any conversation about how big they are. The team will sit together in a room and they'll do exactly what I'm doing right here. We'll go ahead and let them argue and let them talk. And as the product owner, I tend to sit back quietly and just watch. I try not to influence too much how they choose to do the task breakdowns. But I do track it and I do record it and I keep track of it all, and we'll get rid of the ones that they don't want later. I'll just keep doing this. A couple more just so I can be done. Then once we have the tasks done, then it's time for us to go back and talk about that sizing problem. And I do recommend that you, for the purposes of tasks and estimation at this level, when we're talking about the sizing of the work for the crews, it has been my experience that developers will always translate back to hours and days anyway. So you can try to use a made-up point system, and what's going to happen is everybody on the team is going to go, okay, times 4. All right. So he's going to think in his head 2 hours, and he's going to know that for him 2 hours means 8 of whatever you're calling them, jelly beans, gummy bears. So I just go ahead and acknowledge that for tasking out, I use real units. So doing that is, again, quite simple. I'm going to fill in the remaining work column. Now, you might notice that in this form, there is not a field for the initial estimate. Again, this is something that you're going to find the agile disciplines all agree on pretty consistently, is that we really don't care what the initial estimate was. What we care is how much is left. And as the product owner, that's me, I don't really care what the initial estimate was. I care about when I'm going to get it. It's all about me. Selfish. Me. Give me my thing. Do I get it in 2 hours or do I get it in 10? That's what I care about. So really the remaining work is what matters, and the remaining work is the best way we have of keeping track of how something is doing. So we're just going to simply enter that into remaining work, because since it hasn't been started, that's what the remaining work is. I'll just work my way along here, filling these guys in, so we can see what happens. Helps if you put it in the right field, though. And one more. Okay. So now we've got this in here and we can keep track of what we've got. The other thing that we may need to know is, remember I showed you, we were talking about the too big problem, too big, too small. So in order for us to answer that question, we have to give some thought to how much do we have to assign to those hours. So I can say that, you know, every day, Aaron gets about 4 hours of work done because he is a slacker. And every day I get about 6 hours of work done because I'm a little bit less of a slacker. But Aaron has a couple days off this week, so I'm just going to go ahead and put those in as well. He's off today, or else he'd be up here on stage with me. And he's off tomorrow as well. Oh, yes. Sorry. This iteration doesn't start until next month, so it's helping me out there. So now you can see there's a couple things happening. Over here on the right-hand side, we are now showing how much work the team can get done and how much work there is. And we also can see the work as it's assigned by each person. So we can keep track of whether we have accepted enough work into the sprint. All right, save that change. All right, now when we go back over here, we're now going to be able to use this information as we are selecting the work and tasking it out so that we can do that thing of finding when we go over. Go Tech Ed Internet. All right, so once we've done that, we'll do the same kind of thing we saw before, where we might go over, we might go too long, and then we have to play the game of story splitting. So while I'm waiting for that spinning wheel to come back, yes, sir?
So this was the question I was asking before. If I had multiple projects that were working on the same sprint, would you add that to the sprint backlog by itself?
So let me ask a couple questions. The question was asking about multiple projects in the same sprint. Now, I want to ask some clarifying questions, if I may. Is it a single team working on multiple projects? So we have one team working on two things at the same time. So there's a couple of approaches to tackling this. I'll tell you my favorite. I think that what the team works on is what you're tracking, and that that's really what you care about from an execution tracking perspective. Now, there's a couple of ways you can handle that in TFS. You can do that with area path. You can say that I'm going to have the area path correspond to which part of our thing they're working on. So they might do it this area path with this project, this area path with this project. Now, by default, if some of the reports and queries and things in here may need to be adjusted if you take that approach, and if you then want to ask a question about only one of them and not the other, if you want to ask some tracking and trending reports about one of those, you may have to add some querying to your some adjustments to the queries to say where the area path is here or there. That's an approach I've taken. The other is to use two completely different team projects. But the problem I have then is I personally have found that I get confused as to which one I'm looking at, and I don't get this capacity tracking that I really want to have. So you'll see it's telling me that I have far more time available to me than this work has actually taken. Now, if we were to go through and make this a little worse, you can see what's going to happen. I'm going to get it to go over. I'm going to start getting red marks all over the place. And then we'll be able to get a sense of how bad this really is. So just for fun, I'm going to make this one 100. And then we will make the other one another 100, and we'll clearly go over then. But what we're not seeing is you'll see nothing has been assigned to anybody yet. So what we're seeing is that the sprint has gone over, but we haven't assigned it to people. So the other way that you can go over is by over allocation. Now, the allocation thing is another one of those kind of questionable up in the air topics that Agile teams will argue over and Agile philosophers will argue over about do you assign work or do developers select work? Which way does it go? Is it a push model or a pull model? I happen to be a big fan of the pull model. So generally speaking, for my teams, I don't ever assign work at this point in time. Because remember, the imaginary point in time where we are right now is at the beginning of a sprint, and we're planning out the work we're going to do. So what I am most interested in is that box at the top that has now gone red. I am most interested in, have we exceeded the capacity of the team? I'm not interested in putting the work on people. Now, I can start to assign work to people. So if I were to take this one and assign it to Aaron, what you're going to see is Aaron now goes red. Okay? And so if you are working in an organization where you want to keep track of people allocations and whether you have enough in that regard, you still can do that. You also may not have noticed that when I did capacity setting, I also said that Aaron and I are both working on development. There are a lot of teams out there who like to keep track of the different kind of aspects of the work done. Right? Is it the design work? Is it the requirements tracking? Is it the testing? Is it whatever? And if you want to do that, you'll notice that over here on the right-hand side, I'm also getting a track, excuse me, of whether we have exceeded in that kind of category of work. Because you may have only one person who can do documentation. You may have one doc writer on your team. And that person has exceeded we've exceeded what they can accomplish. So there's a lot of different ways to use this and to keep track of it and use it for trending and for figuring out when you have too much or too little work in your sprint. So the team then will use this as they're doing their work and as they're working through their stand-ups and their daily activities. The other thing that is interesting is to start paying attention to the backlogs and all those other things, and we'll get to that in just a second. So let's go back over here. So as we start to talk about the execution part, so this is the loop that happens with a developer beginning his day. Right, so you come into the morning, everybody comes in, we get together for our morning scrum or stand-up meeting, and we all start to talk about what we're doing. Now, there's a bunch of different things that happen while we're doing that. We're going to pay attention to our burndown chart. We've got that there at the bottom. We're going to be looking at what the stories are in the product backlog, and we're going to be keeping track of our work done. So we'll update our tasks and say, okay, there's no longer 10 hours remaining on that. There are now 3 hours remaining on that. And we'll continue to work our way along. Now, once the developer returns back to his desk and says, okay, I'm going to go work on this task, it is recommended that you take an aggressive unit testing approach to your work. Scrum recommends it. Extreme Programming mandated it. And so what I'm going to talk a little bit about is about what test-driven development looks like. Right? So test-driven development is something that sometimes people call red-green refactor. Simple process where you write a failing test. I say simple because it's easy to describe, not because it's easy to do. You write a failing test, you write some code. The test passes, you do it again. Write some more code, the test passes, you do it again. You write some code, the test passes, and then you take a look and you realize, I have a lot of duplication in here. Because that's one of the other things that you'll typically do while doing test-driven development is you'll make sure to use the simplest possible implementation you can to make that test pass. You won't aggressively design your answer. You'll make the test pass. And the reason you do that is because this is very much like the scientific method. We want to try to get the experiment under control. And we get it under control by having passing tests, by being able to constrain the environment. So what we're going to do now is, while those tests are green, we refactor. Refactoring in this context, and by this definition, is changing the implementation without changing the behavior. Yes, sir?
When you go through and create...
That's okay. I'll repeat it.
When you go through and create the tests, do you go ahead and basically establish the happy path that you're expecting to do, as opposed to all these wild ideas that could happen?
All right, so the question is, when I'm writing the tests, do I create the happy path, or do I kind of cover the... all the crazy things that could happen. So from a test-driven development perspective, we're going to do this one single test at a time. We'll write a single test, we'll make it pass. Write a single test, we'll make it pass. Now, I would argue that a good developer will always explore all of the edges of that while they're doing this. At the same time, you want to be very cautious not to gold plate. Now, gold plate would be going beyond what is required of the acceptance criteria for the story. So there's a careful balance there. I do not think it is reasonable or smart to ignore failure conditions when we're writing our code. And so what I like to do is, I'll show you this in just a second, is I will put a comment block at the bottom of the code, the very bottom of the test file. And down there, I'll put in lists of all the tests I still want to write that I haven't done yet. Okay? So when we refactor, then we're going to keep our tests passing. The tests are the confirmation that we have not changed the behavior of the system. They're the definition of what the system currently does. So we collapse that code, we refactor it, we make it simpler, we make it smaller, we make it better. And then we can continue on our merry way, writing more tests and writing more code. Now, I've got a few things I want to cover in here, so let's start with stand-up. So when the team comes together for stand-up, what I like to do is to use the TFS task board. Here we go. The task board is a nice, easy way for the team and for individuals and even for the product owner to keep track of what the work, what the state of the work is and how much is remaining right now. So the way we typically will do this is the developer will go up to the board, if you have one in your team room, and say, all right, so I'm still working on this one. Actually, they don't need to do that. I'm still working on this one, and there's 2 hours left. That's all I had to do. Right? And Aaron will come over and say, all right, I'm going to be working on this one. So he'll drag it over there. And I don't think it's got 6 hours. I think it's actually got 7. That's fine. Now, the other way you can use this, and it actually kind of works quite nicely, I'm going to just do a quick edit to make sure I'm clean here, is you can choose this over here and you can knock it down, pick a single person. So I'm logged in so I can see myself. I'm going to say, I want to see me. Now, it's now filtered the list down to highlight the things that are assigned to me. And it's also kind of collapsed the other things. I can still expand them if I want to and take a look at what's going on there. I can even add new tasks because this often happens at stand-up as well. So I discovered yesterday that I'm going to need to do this. So you add it in. Okay? And I'm going to start on that today. Right? Now, because the thing I wanted to show you is because I'm in the view of by me right now over here on the right-hand side, anything I do causes the work to become assigned to me. So I'm going to work on this. Assigned it to me. Right? And I can click here and say it's got 3 hours left. A very easy way now for me to have that conversation with the team and also always be updating TFS. Yes? What numbers? Oh, the task ID? You can't. I don't think you can modify this view. Chris, do you know if you can? You can't modify this view. You can always simply click on it and get to the task ID right here if you need to. I would love to find out later what you want that for, but that's interesting. Yes, sir? Chris? Here we go.
Can you add more states?
Add more states. Yes, so if you're... So the adding of more states is related to the question of can you adjust your work item process template? Okay? So the work item process template defines the states that work items can go through. Again, it's part of the XML file and the designer of the state machine that work items can transition. And in the Scrum 2.0 template, this is the state for tasks. They go from to do to in progress to done. If you are creating your own work item process template or if you're using a different one, you might be using the built-in CMMI template or one of the others. That template can come with its own state, and you can modify those states. Again, though, reminder that on the hosted version of TFS, you can't change the team project template. Okay? It's complicated. Okay, so when I put those states in, though, those states are going to appear for me here. I also can pivot this view. So that the rows now, instead of being the story or the product backlog item that it's associated with, the rows now become the people. And this is another way that I've seen stand-ups run, where the team will switch it into person view, and each person will talk about their own work, and then if they want to grab a piece of work, they drag it like this. And you'll notice that when I drag it over, it actually moved down here, even though I dragged it over up there, because it's doing the assignments for me. It's a very nice way to work, and it actually works quite well with your touchscreen too. So once I've done that, now what I need to do is I need to write some code. So I'm going to just give you a very, very quick demonstration of some TDD type things and how we've made changes to the unit test capabilities in Visual Studio to enable this. If you were already at my unit testing talk on Monday, you're going to have already seen this. If you were not and you want more details on the unit testing stuff, I would encourage you to go back and watch the videos after you're done and after TechEd, and I've done a couple of talks to cover some of this material. Okay, if we, when we're doing TDD, typically what we're going to do, remember we said create a failing test, create a passing test, create a failing test, create a passing test. So I'm just going to go ahead and add a new class here. Now the unit test experience in Visual Studio 2012 has been significantly changed and extended so that we can now support using third-party unit testing frameworks. This was a major ask from customers. So just to demonstrate that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use a different framework than MS Test. I'm going to use a framework called xunit.net, just one that I chose. And so if we're going to pretend that maybe I need to create, I'm going to, for demonstration purposes, I'm going to TDD a little bit in the direction of a thing called a string calculator. It's not really real world, but it demonstrates the point of how TDD works. And so this is going to be a class that, when given a string, takes the numbers that are separated by commas and adds them all up for me. So the first test that I might write is an empty string returns 0. So I often will do this. I'll literally name the test exactly what my expectation is defining. And then I'm going to just start coding away. The class that I'm about to talk to doesn't even exist. The system under test is a new string calculator. We do not even have one yet. This is quite common in TDD. So I'm just gonna, in theory, if you look at the TDD dogmatic literature, it's going to tell you I should actually try to run the tests. But of course, the compiler is going to fail, so we're not going to let them do that. We'll consider that red line to be a failing test. All right, and then we'll say that the input string is an empty string, and then we will collect the result by saying add string. Okay. Now, in order to help force the generator to help me out here, I'm going to tell it that's an int, and then we're going to let him create that function for me. Okay. And, of course, this one should return 0, so we're going to assert that the answer is 0. Now, in a TDD way, what I'm supposed to do at this point is build and run my tests. I haven't done anything yet. There it is. Ah, sorry, I got the wrong test. Empty string. Okay. Ah, that's why. Okay. Let me make that other one go away. Excellent. And there is our test failing. So this is what we expect to see now. We expect our tests to fail before we write any code. Why did it fail? It failed because when Visual Studio does a method implementation, it creates a throw situation. Fine. So let's now just say return 0. I told you we were going to do the simplest thing that could possibly work. We clearly have not implemented a string adder yet. This is very typical for a TDD approach. Now, you were asking earlier, what about all those other tests that I know I want to do? You know, what about the edge cases? What about the happy path versus the not happy path? So this is what I meant when I said I'll create a comment block. I'll keep a list like this sitting at the bottom of my test file, right? And so I will start to establish all kinds of interesting things, like, you know, what happens with null? That's a good one, right? What happens with numbers greater than 1,000? And so I'll start to remind myself of things that I want to explore further on down the road. And I'll keep doing this one test after another until I get to where my system has been fully implemented. So a single digit returns the int, something like that. I'm going to copy all this stuff up here, put it in down here. All right, we want to just put a 1 in there, and we should get a 1 back, not a 2. Okay, Now, I want to point out that what I'm doing in order to run these tests is I'm just building. And I'm building because the new unit test experience has the ability to do a thing we sometimes call the continuous test runner, but more accurately run tests after build. So this makes the test run, the unit test run, feel like it's a part of your build step. My friend Chris, who's sitting right over here, says, you're not building unless you're running your tests. You're only compiling. And so this now lets you have that experience right inside of Visual Studio. Toggle that button, and all of your tests will be running every single time you do a build. So this way, I can stay focused on when I'm doing this kind of a very agile TDD mechanism, I can just stay writing test code, test code, test code. So I need to go over and make that one pass. So let's see. Now I can try return int32.parse on the input. That'll probably get me something. Now this one makes me immediately start to reach for those crazy cases that you were talking about when you were wondering about the not-so-happy paths, right? What happens if I put a letter A in there? Well, I better remember to write a test for that. So I'm going to go, what happens? So I'll go put myself a reminder here. What happens with an unparsable okay? And I'll continue to do this over and over and over as I build up my system. Now, I'm going to stop and not continue to bore you with doing TDD, but instead talk a little bit about the pragmatic aspects of unit testing in TDD. Okay, I can put on the robe and the sandals and all that and come up here and pitch that TDD is the only way you should do development, but I think that would not be honest or pragmatic. Okay? I have participated in the TDD community and written books and articles and magazines and all this stuff for a long time now, and I will tell you, I do not TDD every single thing I do. Instead, what I like to say and what I like to prescribe to people is they should be close together. Writing a test for a bit of functionality and the writing of the bit of functionality should be close together. If you want to do one slightly before the other or the other way around, that's fine. In fact, that's good. What you don't want to have happen is have an extended period of time go by before you write tests for something. And this brings up a point. I had a gentleman come in, can't see you in the lights, but a gentleman come up to me earlier, because we were talking earlier in the week about a pattern for source code management. So I'm going to take just a second and talk about that. There is a pattern that I'm a big fan of that I think works really, really well with agile techniques that is called the story branch pattern. And the story branch pattern goes something like this. When we take a story or a product backlog item, like we did over here, remember when we took some of these and we took them out of the product backlog and we put them into the sprint, when a developer is ready to start working on that story and it's the first task to get done, what you do is you go into the version control system and you create a branch. And you name the branch after the story. And all of your work for that story happens in that branch. And then when you're finished with the story, you run through the acceptance criteria with your test people, with your product owner, with your stakeholders, and it's in the branch. It's protected and isolated from the mainline code that you're shipping. This is particularly important if you were looking at going with a continuous delivery model. Chris gave a great talk on that earlier, continuous delivery to Azure. If you're looking at those kinds of approaches and you really are thinking about that, you want to make sure that before the code goes into main and before you start thinking about pushing it up to your continuous delivery, that it's been through all the checks you want it to be through. And one of the most important checks is that the product owner signed off on it. And the easiest way to do that is to do it in a story branch. You create a branch for the story. Now, how does this relate back to the unit testing thing? Here's how. Imagine that for you to implement that story, the crew spends a full 2 weeks working on it, okay? And you have other people, perhaps on another crew, working on another part of the product, or even other people in your team working on a different story because your team has decided to divide the work up that way, and they're putting stuff up in main as well. If you wait all the way till the end of that 2 week period to try to merge back up, how fun is that merge going to be? So what's the answer? Merge down every day. Every morning, we had this happen. On my cruise, we implemented the story branch pattern for our work, and the developers were really reluctant. They're like, you crazy man, merging is going to be terrible. No way. And at the end of the sprint, one of the guys came back and said, see, I told you. Took me a day and a half to merge back up. I was like, when was the last time you merged down? Well, when I made the branch 2 weeks ago. I said, okay, do me a favor. Try it again and actually listen to my words. Merge down every day. merge down every day, merge down every day. He went back on the next sprint and merged down every day. And at the end of it, he said, merging up didn't take, I was like instant, done, merge up. Exactly. Keep it close together. Keep the work close together with the test. Keep that keep your branch as close to main as you can keep it. Keep things close together. Because what you're really trying to do here is you're trying to fail fast. Fail fast is a favorite phrase of mine. You want your unit tests. You want to know that test is right or wrong early. You want to catch an error that is being forced upon you by a change above you in the branch structure early. You don't want to catch it at the very end of the sprint. So if, as a developer then, as I'm working on the story and I'm doing this, I'm dragging my tasks around and I'm doing my work, I'm doing unit testing, I might be doing TDD, but I'm doing lots of unit testing, lots of integration tests, lots of automated testing. I'm checking it all into the build, into my story branch. The other thing that I really strongly advocate from an execution perspective and for the dev teams is that you are constantly building, and remember, with Chris's definition, and running your tests every single check-in that goes in. So I want to just quickly show you that even though I'm using the TFS preview, the Team Foundation build in the cloud thing, I actually can do my builds up there too. And these builds have been failing because I did some ugly things in my JavaScript code, and I have some JavaScript tests running, and I haven't fixed them today. But this is actually great, because what this is showing me is that the build server is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's also showing me that the development team, me, is not doing what I'm supposed to do, because I left the build broken. And that brings up another point I want to make. There is no rule about don't break the build. Let's be really clear about that. That is not the rule. The rule is don't leave the build broken. And clearly I did. But if we take a look at what's happening here, we can see that it ran all of my tests, and we're having a test failure. Okay, good. I found that. I caught that early. As soon as I checked it in, I got my results back, and I should immediately go and fix that. So here I am using the cloud-based TFS product, and I'm building in the cloud with all kinds of different... I'm using JavaScript and XUnit and all these other things, all pushing it up and building it up there. So I'm going to use my story branch. I'm going to do a lot of unit testing. I've got this continuous integration that's constantly building and running tests on every check-in. The development team now is having a rich conversation with the code. They're building out that feature. When they get to the end, and we're back over here in the storyboard, and we say, okay, we're done with this story now. These guys are all done. Now it's time for me to go to the product owner. I go back to the product owner. I bring up the story. I demonstrate it for him. We demonstrate that all the acceptance criteria are met. At that point now, it's safe for me to merge that story branch back in and delete the branch. Yes, sir? Okay. The question is, and I'll quote you, I have this annoying group called QA. I had to quote you. And how does this break the process? So at Microsoft, we have people who have the title of testers who we think of as QA. And I'm going to give you kind of a two-part answer. I'm going to tell you the way Agile and Scrum will tell you to do it, and then I'm going to tell you how we do it, and then I'm going to tell you based on my own experiences. Officially, Agile and Scrum says there is no difference between the roles. Put them all on the team. They've got to deliver the software. Go. My experience has been, and this is actually kind of how we do it on our teams, or at least on the teams that I work with, is that, in fact, there are people who are really good at breaking things. I think my son is going to be a great tester when he grows up. And there are people who are not. I'm terrible at it. I am a terrible tester. I already said that. I've worked with some testers who are just mind-bogglingly good. They can just immediately look at it and go, ding, 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 there it broke. How do you do that? And so the way I like to do it is I like to kind of take a bit of a halfway approach. I know I've got people on the team who are really good at testing. They're really good at evaluating quality. They understand all the weird things about color. Color is a fascinating one. Colorblindness. Is anybody in here colorblind? I work with a whole bunch of people who are red-green colorblind. I had never considered the impact of red-green colorblind when you're designing a UI that looks like this unit test thing over here. With red and green buttons on it and red and green bars going across. My tester did, and that was great. We had a great conversation about it. And so what I like to say is that, yes, put them all in a room. They're all the team. They've got to deliver the software. Certain people have certain things they're really good at. Let them be leaders in that area. Everybody's got to deliver the software. I do think I should put the QA people on the team and in the room. And so that's what we do. Our teams sit in a team room, and we've got QA people who are officially in the QA org, and they're in there too. And together they work out who's going to get things done. But it's we all know, we the team, we all know that the majority of the testing is going to get done by the QA people while they're working with the team. Now, the other thing I want to point out is that it's not done. Like, I dragged these over here to this column, right? It's not done if it's not tested and ready to go. So I will strongly recommend you you avoid a situation where you have this thing of the development sprint followed by the testing sprint for a story or a body of work. Because if you need to do that, then really you did not finish it in the previous sprint. Okay? That's very, I think that's really important, is being clear about done. Yes, sir?
So you only have, what, three columns here, right? You know, in progress and done.
In this process template, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that again starts to imply the idea that the QA people are not part of the team. And speaking about this from an agile development perspective, that is going to be strongly discouraged. You really do want to try to make sure that all the people who are interested in building this piece of software, and that includes making sure that its quality is sufficient to ship to your customers, you want to make sure that those people are a part of the team as well. I have seen successfully teams do a column between in progress and done that says ready for verification. And that verification also includes verification by the stakeholder and the product owner in addition to QA. I would prefer it if we didn't need that column, because that really starts to encourage us to think about us and them. And one of the other problems with the us and them approach in quality is that then developers start to say, well, I'm a developer. I don't have to write unit tests because I don't do testing. I've actually heard this one. I don't do testing. I'm a developer. It's very important that the developers test their code, and it's very important that your test team, who have the expertise in understanding all the issues around breaking things, have a chance to look at it. And it's very important that the product owner has a chance to look at it. This story, if I go back over to story view here, this story cannot be done until the product owner says it done is done, even if all of the work is in the done column. It's not done until I say it's done, because I'm the product owner. I get to decide when it's done. And so if you have a situation where your QA team has to sign off on it as well, well, it's still not done, because it hasn't moved to that last state yet. That's another way to do it if you're going to use one of the built-in templates, is just say that it's still an active story, but all the tasks are complete, therefore it's ready for QA. Or you can, the other way I've seen it done successfully is that there are QA tasks. You can do that successfully as well. We can imagine that there's a task here which says verify by QA. All right, so now that all of the dev tasks are over here, the QA guy who's going to test this brings it over to here. He tests it until it's done. He drags it across to here. Or you could come along and say, verify by product owner. Product owner is now ready because everything's over there. He pulls it over to here. He spends an hour or two with the product, says, yes, I'm ready to ship it. He drags it over here. Now it's done. And until then, it wasn't. There's a lot of ways to do it. The tool supports you doing a lot of different things. Again, from an agile perspective, official, and that's, you know, the talk here is me telling you about agile. From an agile perspective, you really should try to think about how to bring the team together, get the team to think about the software as something they own together, and try to avoid that us versus them situation. It's going to create problems for you, because you're going to end up with a sprint of design and a sprint of development and a sprint of testing. And at that point, it's really kind of, you're really doing now 3-month-long sprints. So why not just make that smaller and do it all at once? All right, so we've got the branch merged up. The product owner has signed off on the story. The developers come back to stand up the next day and take another task. We just keep doing this over and over and over. Yes, question over here.
Does this process replace the, when you're checking code, you associate with a task and it resolves automatically?
So the question is about when you check in the code and you want to associate the work with a task. So what's interesting is that over here in the Team Explorer, we now have this idea of my work. Chris, did Jamie did a talk this week? There was a session on Monday about this, so I would encourage you to go back through the videos and take a look at it, but I want to just show you roughly how it works. You'll notice that in my available work items list down here, let me just zoom in on that for you real quick. So down here, we have a list of all of the things that are currently assigned to me. And if we were doing a pull model, there would only be the one thing there that I dragged over at stand-up this morning. But in a push model, there can be multiple things. And so what I do is I just take this one and I drag it up here. This is the one I'm now working on. And because this is the one I'm now working on, the work that I do is going to be associated with it. And when I go ahead and say check in, you'll notice it has already related the work item to it. It is also specified that the work item is to be resolved. Now, if I'm doing an intermediate check-in and the work item is not to be resolved, I just change it to associate. It's taking care of that for me. It's a very nice feature where the developer now doesn't have to remember to do that. This is, again, we're trying to make it so all the things that everybody forgets to do are things that just you don't have to remember anymore. I used to have to always remind people to enter their time in. Well, I've got the task board and we're standing there at stand-up. Drag your thing over and put in two, right? I used to have to remind them to associate their work items. Now you just drag the work item up and start working. Now, the other aspect of this that's really nice is I've dragged it up and I've started working, and the boss comes running down the hallway banging on my door. We've got a P0 bug. The site's down. You've got to fix it now. And I'm halfway through some who knows where with all my unit testing. I hit suspend and shelf. I'm going to suspend this work. And we automatically take it, clean it up, put it in a shelf set, push it up to the server, gone, reset my workspace back to zero. Okay? Fix the bug, check it in. Happy, I'm done. I come back over here, and in my suspended work, here it is. I say resume. Notice when I resume, it's more than just the work items. It's more than just restoring my workspace. It even opened up all the windows I had before. So it keeps track of exactly where you were. So you jump over, fix the bug, jump back, and you're right back where you were, staring at the same screen, in the same test, working on the same code. So it's a really nice experience for the developer. They can just stay focused on adding value to the product. Question here, yes? You have only one? So right now, we have only the task board, and the task board is designed for the team to use the way I've been showing you. We are doing, the question was about, do we have other kinds of boards that we can use for different kinds of visualizations. So you saw that I had, I was able to do a lot of things to modify what this board is showing me. So here we can see, I've got the stories on the side with the tasks flowing across. I can go here, and I've got the people on the side with the tasks flowing across. What we don't have is stories, which would be kind of a higher level view, a kind of a portfolio level view. We don't have that right now, but it is something we've been talking about. That's kind of more of a Kanban approach as well. I don't know if you guys have heard of Lean and Kanban, but that is, we are doing a lot of exploration in this area to make sure we can deliver a good product. So don't have any commitments or promises for what we're doing there right now. I don't have anything to announce, but I will tell you that it's an area we're interested in, and we're going to continue to deliver value into this world. Okay, I do need to jump back over here so we can stay on track. Okay, so we do this. Developers are pulling the tasks across, the branches are merging up, the code's getting into main, we're getting ready. And now suppose we're maybe even doing continuous delivery, which means every sprint we might go ahead and push it up to our Azure and get our customers using it. Or we might be doing internal deployments to customers, or we might be doing internal deployments to test groups of customers. There's all kinds of ways to handle this. But what happens is change. You get feedback from customers. You get feedback from management. The marketing team comes along and says, hey, we just made up a crazy new coupon scheme. You got to change the site. Change happens. We need to be able to respond to it. Ultimately, what happens in the face of change is we finish up our work, we're good, and we track our velocity, we're good to go there. as we continue to work our way along, we continue to add new stories. And so we continue this cycle, and we're tracking everything. You'll notice there's a lot more tracking in Agile than most people realize. They think it is cowboy ad hoc, and in fact, there's so much more tracking than I've often found in a traditional waterfall kind of project management. Waterfall's really good at planning and then yelling at you when you're not done. But in the middle, you don't really know where you are. The whole point of the Agile methodology is to say that at any point in time, you know exactly where you are. You're not lost somewhere between here and Buffalo. So responding to changes about reordering the backlog, I said we would be doing this all the time. So we're always adding new stories into the backlog, reprioritizing that backlog, doing that kind of thing. Now, just a little tip and trick from me about prioritization of backlogs. What I really care about on the backlog is about 2 sprints worth of future work. So what that means is, and I had to kind of get my general manager used to this, sometimes you gotta do a little training upstream. What I had to get him used to is the fact that the top, 20% of my backlog is probably stack ranked and organized. The rest of it, I don't know. Because to be honest, I really don't care down there. I'm not gonna go and nitpick whether this one's above that one when I know it's 4 sprints from now. Because to be completely honest, because I'm responding to change, because I'm getting customer feedback or even my own internal feedback, I might not ever do that. Mary Popendick wrote a book called Lean Software Development. And I saw her do a presentation at the Agile conference a couple years ago, and she said, if it's more than 2 sprints away, delete it. I thought that was spectacular, because it's almost what I'm doing. If it's so far away that you can't prioritize it, then you're also saying you're probably not going to do it. And her other point was, if it's really important, it'll come back. So I've been giving you a few kind of lessons from the trenches kind of thing, and this is something that Aaron Bjork and I have been doing for a few years now, and I just wanted to kind of take you through a few things that we've kind of uncovered as we've been adopting Agile. Because when I first joined Microsoft 8 years ago, the Visual Studio teams and the DevDiv teams, not so much Agile. And when I joined the Visual Studio team 4 years ago, I had this not-so-secret mission of make Visual Studio Agile. And of course, you know, I'm not really in a position to make all of Visual Studio Agile, so I started where I could. I made my team Agile. And then we've influenced and we've got other teams now, and it's more and more and more. It's spreading out all the way across the entire organization. And I wasn't the only one, fortunately, because if I had been, we wouldn't have been successful. Lots of people in Visual Studio and in TFS working hard to try to change the way we think about building software. And here's some of the things we've figured out along the way. Be crystal clear about the definition of done. And done occurs at all levels. Done occurs at the task level, the story level, the product backlog item, the sprint, when you're allowed to merge the branch, the release, those acceptance criteria, our unit tests passing, our non-functional requirements, it has to achieve these performance goals. Be crystal clear about it. I don't think you should impose them. Like if you're a manager or a product owner, you don't impose these. These are self-imposed by the team. The second one I've already talked about a couple times is fail fast. You want always, if there's going to be a failure or a crash or a problem or a mistake with merging or anything like that, you want it to happen as early as you possibly can. And that's really the essence of why we do our testing very close to our development, why we merge down all the time in those branches. It's also why we want to make sure that done is defined, because we want to be able to track and catch that as early as we possibly can. If we have our acceptance criteria clearly defined in advance of a story's initiation, then the team and the developer who's working on the work knows whether they've done the work right or not. Instead of that old school thing of the guy comes and tells you to do the feature and you go off and code up the feature and you send it back and he says, that's not what I asked for. No, it's better that the developer can know when he's on track or not because he understands what done is and he can fail fast, or even better, not fail at all. Velocity is very important. In order to do accurate forecasting, and forecasting is much more important than estimating, in order to do accurate forecasting, you have to know how fast you have been going. So you have to know how many stories, how many product backlog items, how many jelly beans, how many story points you have typically finished in any given sprint. That allows you to make a reasonable projection of how many you can finish in the next sprint. finish what you start is related to that thing I said earlier. We do not want a story carrying across the boundary. Everything you start, you should finish. Don't leave things halfway. Just like there's not such thing as half a person, there's not such thing as half a story being done. Sorry, I wasn't supposed to click that. Bugs are real work. Don't think that bugs are different. Bugs are work, track them. They should be on your backlog, they should be on your task board. Write your tests all the time. Unit tests, integration tests, functional tests, acceptance tests. Test your product aggressively, or else your customers are going to find the bugs, and then you have an angry customer. There's a great book by Daniel Pink called Autonomy, called Drive. And basically what it says is that there's three things that motivate people: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. If you take a look at the Agile techniques, you'll find that's consistent. Developers choose their work. Developers care about quality. They want to be masterful in their craft. They actually want to write good code. Even bad developers actually want to write good code. And they should have a sense of purpose. They need to know what this product's for. They need to know what the customers are for. They need to be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Help them understand that. Do the right thing at the right time. Don't do it at the wrong time is another way to say it. And this is really about kind of just in time or last responsible moment. It's not about last chance, last possible moment. When should you design the UI? The last possible moment would be after you've done it. Right? We've all done that. You implement the system and then the design team comes along and revamps it all on you. Well, a little bit before that would be better. And so you find the right point in time in your cycle and do it. When should you detail out all of the tasks of a story before you do it, but not months before you do it? So plan until you need to learn. Always be planning. Always be learning. Have retrospectives. Work together as a team. If you don't know the answer to a question that you need to be able to plan better, figure out how to ask the question. Work together and figure that out. And quality is not a variable. There's the iron triangle of project management, right, which has scope, time, and resources. It does not have quality. Don't let it be a variable. If you lock in all three of those, you just let quality be a variable. One question here, and then I need to move. So the question is, how do you convince a team moving from waterfall to agile? And that is a question that will take more time than I have, so let's do talk later. So we are out of time, but there are no sessions after this, so if you have questions, please come up and let's talk about it. Also, here's all of my contact information. I will be at the TLC downstairs. And a quick question before you go, just listen. We've been having a hard time getting people to fill out their evaluation forms. We've been very light on some of the evals. So if you get a chance this evening before you go off and start partying and having a good time, please fill out your eval forms. Thank you very much, and have a great rest of your evening. Hi, how are you? Okay.